So we have moved on to our next guest, which is very exciting. I can't believe it's Friday here at AirVenture already. It happens so fast. I have in front of me Paul Dye. Paul has an illustrious and long CV, so long that we would use the whole session talking about. So Paul is the editor-in-chief of Kip Planes Magazine, which is an awesome magazine, and I have worked with Paul.
You know, it's awesome because I have awesome people like Amy working with us once in a while. Yeah.
That is exactly true. You focus on the nuts and bolts of building airplanes.
We really do. Yeah. We really do. You know, we focus primarily on amateur-built experimental aircraft, and we want the DIY aspect. We want the details of how you do it. So people, when they read one of our articles, they can go to their shop or go out to their airplane and use what they've learned.
Yeah, that's what I love about it. I know that I see people tearing up the magazines, cutting them out.
Yes.
You know, and these are guys who laminate crap.
Yeah. and they put it up on the walls, or they put it in their builder's notebook. And that is so gratifying when we see that kind of stuff, you know. And we have a great collection of authors. Everybody's a builder, a pilot, an expert in whatever they're doing. And they're all contributing just to make a better knowledge base for everybody else.
Well, and this is a real mecca for you. This is like a homecoming every year.
It is. It is. You know, I get to come back and I get to see airplanes, but I get to see people. Every year I come to Oshkosh, I realize that I spend more time talking to people and less time looking at airplanes. I kind of know before I get here what airplane I'm going to look at, what airplanes I need to see, and what I'm going to try and fly. But it's so fun to walk the grounds and people recognize me and I recognize them from years past, and we stop and we chat. And I tell people, I don't think I've been south of Theater in the Woods for a couple years. Now, the truth is I try to get to Ultralights at least once.
Of course.
But boy, I'll tell you, it's hard to walk through without seeing somebody I know.
It is. I can only imagine. I can only imagine. Well, you know, we had James Wiebe of Belight yesterday, and he was telling us about the Chipper 2.
The Chipper 2.
Yeah.
I just saw that, and it's looking really nice.
Yeah, I got to get down there. In fact, I promised him I would be down there.
Okay.
So
yep,
I will
that.
Be there.
Very
I will
good.
Be there. So yesterday, you did some loss of control stuff. Talk to me about
that.
That's
Wednesday.
Like a bugaboo
during
this whole conference.
Right. You know, if you look at all of the experimental amateur-built accidents, we find that the largest single category is loss of control. Now, there are a couple of things lumped into that loss of control, and some of those have more to do with a pilot's judgment than they're just purely losing physical control of the airplane. But the Pilot Proficiency Center here has created three scenarios that people can go practice that are kind of the big killers. One is the attempt to turn back after an engine failure on takeoff, which everybody is taught you don't do, and so many people try to do, and they do it badly, and therefore they die.
That's the impossible turn.
That's the impossible turn, which, you know, I like to say it's the nearly impossible turn, but for us average pilots, it's impossible. You're going to die if you do it and you screw it up. The next scenario was the low high-speed pass with a pull-up at the end. You know, there's only one reason to do that, and that's to show off. A lot of folks say, well, I need to clear my runway to make sure there's no horses or dogs.
Uh-huh.
I tell them, you know, if that's the case, why don't you make it a low-speed pass so you can actually see something? But a lot of folks come to grief with that. And then the third scenario is the base to final stall spin, which is really, to me, that's not a judgment thing. The first two are judgment things. And the third one is something that just happens and catches pilots due to various effects. And so you can go practice those in a simulator at the Pilot Proficiency Center. And Wednesday, we wanted to highlight that a little bit and talk about it. So I was asked to join a couple of really illustrious folks on the panel. Michael Goulian, folks who've watched aerobatics much will know that name.
And Red Bull.
He's a big Red Bull racer. And then Charlie Precourt. Charlie introduces himself as an Air Force pilot and and a guy who flew into space a couple times, and then I say, and I'm the guy who launched him into space a couple times. So Charlie was a great coworker back in the space program. He was a shuttle commander and chief of the astronaut office when I was lead flight director for that stuff. So we got together and had this discussion, there was a good crowd, and it was all recorded, so it's supposedly to be made available.
That's fabulous. Yep. Do you have any idea where it's being made available? More than likely the NTSB safety briefings?
It'll be EAA somewhere on the website. And the idea is to record it so that it can be sent out to chapters, EA chapters, and made available to folks for presentations and things like that.
That's fantastic. Now, I have a plant in the Pilot Proficiency Center.
I know that. Yeah.
Inside
information.
Source. And he tells me that it's really wild to see the variation in the skill level of the people who are coming in and trying out flight simulation for the very first time.
I'm not surprised. You know, flying a simulator, there are folks who say you don't fly simulators, you play with them. But you can really get yourself immersed in a good flight simulator to where it's hard to tell the difference between the airplane and the sim.
Well, I have to say that it's been my experience that the more experienced the pilot, the more realistic it's going to be in the sim and the more valuable it becomes. It's a curious sort of thing. I can teach someone in the sim. In fact, I've done 5 hours with primary students on procedures, and I think it's an excellent procedures trainer. You don't need motion. You don't need 10 surrounds, screens or anything like that. But you can teach them the basics of starting an airplane, using a checklist, taxiing, takeoff, climb, cruise. You know, here's the things you need to do. Trimming.
You're right. Right.
There's nothing like having a really super sensitive, and people complain, this is too sensitive. My airplane doesn't fly like that. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe it should. If it was an experimental, it could.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. A little lighter touch is a good thing to learn from day one.
Right.
And I find that fascinating. Now our simulators are so sophisticated that even when I play with my Wing X, at home, I can do a pretty good job of getting the control feedback to be about the same
about
as
the same
stick
as what you want.
On my RV-10.
Right.
Yeah.
I visited a young fellow who's building an RV-10 out in the middle of Nevada, and I'm working with him as his technical counselor. And in his spare bedroom, he has a virtual reality setup for his simulator, I think it's Wing X. And I put on the goggles, and it's got sensors that track where you're looking, and it felt like I was sitting in the cockpit of the airplane.
Well, that augmented reality, that virtual reality is where everything's going now.
Because when you turn your head and you can see out the window, it's so much different than just watching that old screen that we had ahead of us in the old days.
Well, Thrustmaster is doing that right here at the show. It's pretty intense what they're doing, and they've got a special seat, and so things sort of move, but only just enough
to give you that
to
that,
give you the rest of it.
Right.
Exactly. And now I saw French companies actually got a five-fingered glove so that your hand can reach out and touch the Garmin 1000 in front of you. Push the buttons just like you would in the real thing.
And so you sit there watching this person with goggles and these funny gloves just kind of moving their hands around in space, and they think they're doing stuff, but they're not. We used to do a spacewalk training that way back in the space program, and you'd see this person just waving their arms and moving their feet and stuff, and they're not touching anything, but in their world, they are.
I saw it with the parachute simulator over in the drone zone. And the guy's got they've got the toggles, and they're sitting in a sling that's supposed to be the parachute.
Okay.
And you can see they got the goggles on, and they're pulling.
Oh, I need to go see that.
Oh,
that
you need
like
to go over to the Innovation Center. Just go over to the Innovation Center because you're you. All of your background, you will have such a good time on that little corner over there.
It's a neat place. I was over there to pick up a wing bug. Now, have you seen the wing bug?
No, tell me about
it. It's the size of a Nerf football.
Okay.
About a half-size football with a little pitot tube sticking out of the end and a GoPro mount. And it is a complete ADA HARS, which is an air data system, air heading reference system, and GPS. You hang it under the wing of the airplane. It talks to your iPad. It records your whole flight. They designed it primarily for flight training so that an instructor can stick it on the airplane, record the whole flight, come back and debrief it. I looked at it and I said, you realize you have the ultimate flight test instrument there, because if we have an airplane that we've never flown before, we don't know whether the air data system is accurate or not. We don't know if the pitot-static is going to tell us the right things. We can go out there, stick this on the wing, and record the flight, and then we can compare it to, because it's a known value. So they loaned us one at Kitplanes, so we're going to take it, and we have one of our regular riders is a crack test pilot. And he knows his airplane's calibrations perfectly. So we're going to put the wing bug on there, and we're going to test the wing bug. And then from all I've heard, it's going to be very accurate. We're going to use that when we do flight tests of airplanes. We don't depend on the aircraft's instrumentation.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I got to believe that the price point is in there in a region where it makes sense for home builders to buy one.
Right. And it would make sense for an EAA chapter to own one.
Well, yeah, because we know we do that with an expensive tool.
We do with
for
expensive
instance.
Tools like scales and things like that. Exactly. And as a flight instructor, if you want to be able to debrief the flight in the end, and you're flying in older 150s or 152s that don't have data recording systems, you stick that on the wing, you come back, you can sit down and get a lot of more benefit out of that flight.
That's wild. So, Paul, you're here at AirVenture this week, but where can people find your writing and more about this stuff on the web? Because we have a lot of internet listeners.
Sure. Well, we're pretty easy to find. www.kitplanes.com. Kitplanes.com. It's hard to enunciate that sometimes.
Yeah, no, I understand
that. But if you go there to the homepage, you'll find my occasional kneeboard notes, which I try and write semi-occasionally, I say, when a couple of them a week, something like that, unless I'm traveling. And then we have Newsline, and we have other things that we have from all our contributors.
Terrific. And you do have a stand here at the air show, too, don't
we
you?
We do. In Building A, we have our subscription folks standing by to give you a Kitplanes subscription.
Paul Dye, Editor-in-Chief of Kitplanes Magazine, thank you so much for stopping by EAA Radio and giving your perspective on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.